Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to call to order the Property and Local Tax Division of the Minnesota House. Our first order of business, Representative Morgan, House File 173. Representative Morgan, I owe you and your testifiers an apology for running overtime last week. Overtime might tie into Representative Paymar's bill about baseball. Do they do overtime in baseball? They do extra innings. They don't do overtime. Okay. As committee members know, my sports metaphors don't go well, although I had a good one going on baseball in the bullying hearing last week. Yeah. You got to give me that.
Yes, you did.
Okay. But all that's a long way of, again, my apologies for running over last week. We do not yet have a quorum, so we cannot move your bill, but you can certainly begin while the committee assembles. Representative Morgan, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee members. No apologies necessary, of course. I am pleased to have a chance to testify before the committee on my bill, House File 173, which will move when we have a quorum. This bill, House File 173, is a much less nuanced effort than yours last week, Mr. Chair, to restore the renter's property tax credit. Mm-hmm. We saw it fall from 19% to 17%, essentially a tax increase on low-income renters, on seniors, on people with disabilities who rent for their homes, and this is an effort to restore that. It's again, there's no nuance to it, but Nan Madden will be here, is here to talk a little bit about the impact of what restoring this could be and what those cuts meant to renters. So I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Madden from the Minnesota Budget Project.
Thank you, Representative Morgan. Mr. Hines, can you just walk briefly through the recent history on the renter's credit and the imputed percentage of rent that is property taxes? It's jumped up and down a little bit over the last few years, and I'm just wondering if you could refresh members' memories of that, please.
Mr. Chairman, I will give it my best shot. I think Ms. Mandy will correct me if hopefully I go wrong. The percentage had been at 19% prior to 2010, and then in the unallotment, I believe, and then in the legislation in 2010, it was reduced to 15% for 1 year only or 2 years, which then it was restored to, but set to go back up to 17% when that temporary lowering to 15 expired. So it's now sitting at 17%.
All right. Thank you. And Representative Morgan, we now have a quorum, so I'd like to officially call the committee to order. The chair moves that House File 173 be before the committee for possible inclusion in the division report. With that taken care of, Ms. Madden, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Nan Madden. I'm director of the Minnesota Budget Project. We are an initiative of the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits that provides independent research, analysis, and advocacy on budget and tax issues, with particular attention to the impact that state fiscal decisions have on low and moderate income Minnesotans. Last week, you heard a number of testifiers on the importance of making improvements to the renter's credit this year so that it can continue to be an effective tool in reducing the regressivity of the property tax. And you also heard about the real difference that the renter's credit makes to low-income families, to seniors, and to people with disabilities. The property tax refund, or PTR, is the targeted tool that the state uses to make sure that Minnesotans don't pay too much of their incomes in property taxes. And it recognizes that both homeowners and renters pay property taxes, although they pay it in different ways. More than 300,000 low and moderate income Minnesota households receive the property tax refund for renters or renter's credit. They're found in every county of the state. The renter's credit is very focused on those with low incomes, and nearly 80% of the households who receive the renter's credit have household incomes below $30,000. More than one quarter of those households receiving the renter's credit include seniors or people with disabilities. And in 12 greater Minnesota counties, at least one half of the participating households include seniors or people with disabilities. Without the renter's credit, rental property taxes are among the most regressive taxes in the state. But the funding for the renter's credit isn't keeping up with growth in rental property taxes. And as mentioned, in 2011, the renter's credit was cut by 13%, or $26 million, and that has weakened its impact today. We think it's clear that improvements to the renter's credit are needed so it can continue to be successful in ensuring that low and moderate income Minnesotans aren't paying too much of their incomes in property taxes. And we urge you to pass improvements to the renter's credit this session. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify regarding House File 173? Please come forward. Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Tracy Fishman. I'm the Executive Director for Accountability Minnesota. And I want to provide my formal testimony, which you also will have distributed during this time. And I also, if it's okay, at the will of the chair, I'd like to just very briefly respond to some discussion that happened last week about the role that community free tax providers can play in really increasing both awareness of free tax programs and providing access to free opportunities for people so that they can file and claim their renter's credit. And that will be very brief. So again, my name is Tracy Fishman, and I work at Accountability Minnesota. We are a nonprofit organization that provides low and moderate income taxpayers with free tax and financial services and therefore help them become financially secure. Thank you for this opportunity to testify before you to discuss our support for House File 173 and the importance of improving the renter's credit to help low and moderate income renters offset the impact of property taxes that they pay each year. Thank you to Representative Morgan and Representative Dabney for your leadership, and thank you to this committee for your efforts this session to address the adverse impact property taxes can have on low and moderate income renters in Minnesota. By way of brief background, our organization leverages the expertise of more than 550 trained volunteers, and in 2012 we served 12,445 taxpayers and helped return $22.6 million in tax refunds in the Twin Cities. Thousands of these taxpayers received the renter's credit. To be more specific, 6,225 of these customers received the renter's credit or a property tax refund. We are not able to pull out of the property tax refunds those that are renters versus those that own their homes, but the vast majority of our customers do rent, and so we know that a huge proportion of those 6,200 plus taxpayers receive the renter's credit. We also offer an array of financial services and products to help our customers save and maximize the financial impact of their refunds, a time we refer to as an opportune money moment. And finally, we train many other organizations, mostly in greater Minnesota, to provide similar services in their communities. Refundable tax credits, including the renter's credit, provide great relief to hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans each year and make a big difference to families. What's more, the customers who claim the renter's credit through high-quality free tax programs like ours, and there are more than 250 of them in Minnesota, ensure that recipients can keep 100% of their refunds. This is extremely important as the vast majority of the people we serve and those who receive the renter's credit have incomes below $30,000. We know from both research and our own experiences that taxpayers use their refunds to meet basic needs, like paying rent, paying bills, catching up on things, putting food on their table, and we hope that ideally they can set aside at least some of their refund to save for a rainy day and a brighter future. What's more, these tax credits benefit local communities. We have countless stories from customers noting what a difference both tax refunds and our services make in their lives. Davina, one of many, told us that every dollar of her refund counts. She sees tax time as an opportunity to catch up and to get ahead. As you likely know, more than 300,000 Minnesota households claimed the renter's credit last year. Renters must be included in any reform that happens, and improvements to the renter's credit, as reflected in House File 173 and other bills that have been introduced, such as House File 2, will make a difference in the lives of thousands of Minnesotans. I would be happy to serve as a resource on these issues. I've provided an accompanying fact sheet on our organization, and my phone number and email address are included on there. So Chairman Dabney and members of the committee, thank you again for this opportunity to testify and support this legislation. And then I also just very briefly want to talk a little bit more about the role of these free tax providers. We are part of a program called the Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program. We are one of, as I said, over 250 throughout the state of Minnesota. We are one of also 39 grantees that receive funding through the Taxpayer Assistance Grants Program that we hope actually will receive some additional funding this year as reflected in the governor's proposed budget request. And while a lot of these taxpayers, tax providers, are only open during the tax season, there are some like ours that are open all year. And so as you had discussed last week, people don't necessarily get their bills and the opportunity to claim their renter's credit until sometimes after the tax season ends. And I want to be clear that there are providers like ours that are open the entire year. And we provide a lot of outreach, a lot of tools for people that can't afford to go to a paid provider so we can support them in their efforts to claim their renter's credit. And we welcome any opportunities to partner with you as well to provide outreach to your constituents so that they know about free tax providers throughout Minnesota. And with that, I will answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much. Let's shift first to Ms. Schill, if you would walk through, please.
Mr. Chair and members, in the packet for House File 173, you have a revenue estimate. I'll draw your attention to that it should be dated March 4th. There was a revenue estimate done for February 25th, but since then we've had an update in the forecast, and so the March 4th is the one that you should be looking at. This bill has an effective date beginning in 2013 for returns filed in 2014. The impact of that would be on the general fund for fiscal 2015, $29.3 million, for fiscal 16, $29.9 million, and for fiscal 17, $30.6 million.
Thank you very much. Any questions from members? Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Morgan, what is the actual percentage of rent that constitutes property taxes?
Representative Morgan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, I would imagine it varies from place to place. I don't know the exact answer to your question.
Representative Torkelson?
Well, I'm hoping there's someone who can provide that information for us.
Would that be a Ms. Manzi question? Ms. Manzi, I know revenue has done some analysis on a regional basis across the state, because the answer to Representative Torkelson's question is partially determined by where you're paying the rent.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry I did not hear Representative Torkelson's question. If he could restate it, please.
Oh, I'm just asking for information about what the actual percentage of rent that goes to property taxes might be.
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, the Department of Revenue periodically reviews data from the U.S. Census Bureau American Community Survey. They issued a one-page update of that information in January, which I can provide to you and the committee. This update shows from the American Community Survey for 2008 through 2011 the estimated percentage of rent that constitutes property tax statewide. Within the metro area, it has detail for the city of Minneapolis, the city of St. Paul, and then the remaining four, the balance of Hennepin County, the balance of Ramsey County, and Anoka and Dakota County. So it's not our typical seven-county metro. It's a four-county metro, and they have for that the portion that excludes Minneapolis and St. Paul, since those are detailed separately. And then also for the non-metro, which would be the rest of the state. To give the statewide figures, for 2008, the estimate was 14.8%. For 2009, 15.1%. For 2010, 14.8%. and for 2011, 14.7%. And I think this may have been in your folders at last Tuesday's hearing, but I certainly will provide it to the committee and to you to be distributed.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Morgan, it's from the information we've received, it sounds like the actual percentage of rent going to property taxes is in moving in a downward direction, and is what we're paying in renter's credit is already above these stated percentages. Why would we raise this at this time?
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Torkelson, thousands of renters in my district have relied on the renter's property tax credit to pay their bills, to pay for their kids going to college, to put food on the table, and they got less of that back. Now, I guess we could demagogue what you call that, but I think it's a step in the right direction to make sure those folks have the money they need to do that what they were doing with that. If we're going to change the way we refund taxes, I think we ought to go and do it last on the people who can least afford to pay more.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm new to this committee, Representative Morgan, and I'm new to the details of renter's credit. I just took it at face value that this was a renter's credit for property taxes paid, and so that I thought that the program reflected actual rent, and you're giving me an indication that it has nothing to do with rent or with property taxes as a percentage of rent.
Mr. Representative Morgan.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Manzi just gave the current status of where the renter, where the property tax as a percentage of rent was. I don't know what the historical motion of that is over time. All I'm saying is it was at 19%. And when it goes below 19%, that hurts people. And these are people who will least afford to pay, get less of that money back. So I think that this is a good move to put more money in the people in the pockets of people who can least afford to have money taken from them.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Morgan, for that. We're on two different tracks here, obviously, and I'm not going to pursue it any further. I'm just trying to figure out what percentage of people's rent is property taxes and whether or not this program is meant to relieve them from that burden, and I'll leave it at that.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Torkelson's question, I've actually been working with a variety of people, including Ms. Manzi, trying to figure out a better way to measure this. But I think it's, first of all, it's important to know that when they do it after the American Community Survey of the Census, the data that we were given was lagged 3 years. That's 2010 data. And anyone who's watched the rental market has seen that rents have gone up dramatically. There's much more demand for renting. People can't accumulate the big down payments. The banks are, you know, much more difficult to get mortgages approved. We have a lot of people who have unfortunately lost their houses when they lost employment during the recession. And so there's actually evidence of record vacancy, low vacancy rates across in many parts of the state that have really forced rents up. So I think that those numbers really don't reflect, you know, current economic situations. The other thing that, you know, I think is we have to take into account, too, is that I was surprised to learn that the Department of Revenue doesn't automate and calculate based on the information they actually get from Minnesota landlords, but there are I'm trying to find some other sources that would be much more timely that maybe would help with that. But we do need to I think, step up and make sure that this program works for the people it was intended to serve. And it's not the fault of the renters that we have to always use 3 or 4 years lagged information. We don't have that for homeowners. We use current information about what their tax bill, all those sorts of things. And so we have to work with the data that's available, and we're trying to see if we can get something better.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Fishman, do you know what the average refund is for renters in these different areas that Ms. Manzi noted?
Ms. Fishman.
Yes, thank you. Representative Erickson, unfortunately, we are, because of our tax software data, We have had trouble pulling out the specific data of all of the state refund data that combines the Minnesota Working Family Credit with the property tax refund data. I think with some additional time, I can see what we can pull out, and at least maybe get a sample of stuff and pull it out by hand. So I will try to follow up with you. I can tell you that the population that we serve in the Twin Cities is of the average, knowing that the average renter that gets the renter's credit is about $30,000, the average income of the people that we serve is $14,000. And so it is not necessarily indicative of the aggregate of the population in Minnesota that receives the renter's credit. With that said, I'd be happy to try and pull some additional data.
Thank you. I'd appreciate that.
Representative Keel. Oh, I'm sorry, Ms. Manzi, I missed the cue.
Mr. Chair and Representative Erickson, I think the data that Ms. Fishman would be able to provide you would be data on the average renter property tax refund of people who claimed renter property tax refunds at sites that are administered by Accountability Minnesota.
Okay.
What you may be asking for is the average renter property tax refund of all people who claimed renter property tax refunds, which the Department of Revenue provides annually by county and breaks out for senior and disabled claimants and non-senior and non-disabled claimants. And I believe that information was also included in the folders last week. There's a handout that Ms. Madden prepared, which was in the folders last week, titled Who Receives the Renter's Credit, and that's another piece of information that I think that we can get to the committee. So I just wanted to add that.
Thank you.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to ask what Representative Torkelson did, but in the meantime, there was a thought that went across my head. When you apply for property tax, if you have income that takes care of all your needs, but you're renting, do you still get a property tax credit, a refund, because you're renting?
Who wants it? Ms. Madden.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so the renter's credit calculation is a multi-part formula. So in order to receive the renter's credit, first of all, that percentage of rent that is considered your share of property taxes has to exceed a certain share of your income. So you don't automatically get a renter's credit just because you're a renter. That your considered share of property taxes has to exceed a certain share of your income, and that is a percentage that slides up as your income goes up. And then there's also you only get refunded a portion of your taxes over that amount.
Okay. Thank
Representative
you.
Kiel?
Thank you.
All right. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Testifiers, Ms. Fishman and Ms. Woodard?
Madden.
I'm sorry. Madden. Has it been your experience that I think I heard one of the other representatives say that the vacancy rates have been declining and that demand for rent is high? Are rents going up? And if so, do you have an idea of how much of a percent they've gone up recently?
Ms. Madden?
Mr. Chair, Representative, my understanding is that the vacancy rate for affordable housing is quite low at this time, with more people renting. One of the many unfortunate outcomes of the foreclosure crisis is more people renting. So my understanding is that there is more pressure on rents these days, but I can follow up with some of our colleagues who follow this information more closely and get back to you on that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Good. Chair.
All right. Representative Hertas.
Thank you. So it would seem that if in the market that we're at, if rents are rising, doesn't that somewhat self-serve itself in terms of a percentage of rent? If your rent is going up, you would be getting larger credits if it's just based on a percentage rent.
Ms. Madden?
If it is the case that your rent is going up and your income is staying the same, yeah, all things being equal, you would receive a larger credit, because the credit is both based on the amount of your rent, but also your income, and to some degree, whether you're senior or disabled and your family size.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hertas.
Okay, so I'm not familiar with the renter rebate sure. program, so there is a point in which your income rises to a level you're no longer eligible for the refund, is that correct?
Ms. Madden.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hertas, that's correct. It's roughly somewhere in the ballpark of $50,000, $55,000, where you no longer are eligible for the renter's credit. That's about half the level as it is for homeowners. And as I mentioned previously, about 80% of the families who receive the renter's credit have incomes $30,000 or less, and that's a very comprehensive measure of income as well.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Representative Hertas.
Just a closing comment. Why don't we take the mystery out of this and just have the landlords certify what they pay in property taxes and divide it by the number of units?
Representative Hertas, there's history to that question. Ms. Schill, would you please enlighten us as to the history?
Mr. Chair and members, the history predates me, but what I will tell you is that a couple of years ago we had an inquiry equal to that, what you just asked, and we took we asked Department of Revenue to not only provide a revenue estimate, but a fiscal note. The fiscal note came back with a cost impact just to administer that portion of the PTR, renter's credit, and it was over $1.2 million. Actually gathering each landlord's bit of information, processing it, and then kicking it back out. It takes a tremendous amount of work power.
And Representative Hertas, I can share that in the past, representatives of the landlords have testified preferring a fixed rate.
Okay.
Because not only is it about the state's administrative burden, for larger landlords that may have properties in multiple jurisdictions, it's easier for them if it's a fixed imputed rate than if they have to calculate the certificate of rent paid individually for each unit or at least each building that they own and rent.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I dread that such a simple solution should be so difficult to administer.
You know, I guess it's which end of simplicity are you looking at? Because this actually ends up being simpler in some ways.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hertas. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Morgan, for bringing this forward. A couple years ago, we had the 35th birthday for the renter's credit and property tax refund programs. Chair Lincheski and I and members helped organize that. We had a cake and the whole works, and that program's been around now 37 years. It was in 2010, and we had Governor Anderson back, Speaker Sable, House Chair Kelly, and Republican Senator Olson, I think, who was in the Senate that helped put that bill through. So, I mean, it's been a very important program, and I know Representative Torkelson asked Representative Morgan, you know, if it doesn't quite match up, you know, 14, 15, 16%, whatever that is, the actual rent, why are we looking at 19%? And as Ms. Madden said, the amount of the property tax is actually just the starting point, because then you're using income, you're using threshold, and so forth. So you could actually back into any number you wanted. But the point is that, and I appreciate the scrutiny on this program like we should have for every single program, but there are other things in our tax code that cost just as much that don't get any review, much less. You know, the mortgage interest deduction. You know, that, I forget, that's $200-300 million a year, I think. And yet the studies show, when Chair Lincheski looked at this, that in fact it does not increase home ownership, incentive for home ownership. And I think Canada and the state of Wisconsin, which does not have the mortgage interest deduction, has a higher percent of home ownership than Minnesota. And so the point here is we could look at every one of these programs, and I guess what really got under my skin a couple years ago is that when we have like a $3 billion budget in the property tax aids and credit, and we were looking for a small amount to cut, and they focused on this program. Now, when you could look at all of these other levers and other programs that are out there, and it seems like when we come to scrutinize these programs, the ones that get scrutinized the most are the ones that really need the programs the most, as you said, Representative Morgan. And you talk to folks on the renter's credit, and they usually get that credit in August. And I talk to a lot of folks that's right when they take their kids out and buy their school supplies and clothing. I mean, these are dollars that these folks get that are put back into the economy immediately, not for frivolous items, for everyday necessary goods or services. And so I guess just looking at the big picture, I think there's nothing wrong with scrutinizing this program, but boy, I wish we'd take a look then at all of them and really look at which ones really serve the purpose they're doing. I mean, we're spending, well, billions of dollars in things that hardly get a view, and we don't even know if they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. I know this one, although it might not match up dollar for dollar always, and I don't know how you calculate, but I know this one is meeting its goal probably as much as any of them. And so I appreciate you bringing this forward, and I hope we can do something to keep this stable, because a large percent is those with senior citizens and those with disability, and I appreciate the testimony today.
Thank you, Representative Marquardt. Representative Erickson. Last comment, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Marquardt, I think the reason we scrutinized it 2 years ago is that we're one of 12 states that provides a renter's credit, and so that, you know, raises some questions. Why are we, you know, doing this? So I don't think it's intended to hurt anyone, just that it pops up because we are not among 48 states that do this. We're one of 12.
Representative Morgan, any last closing comments, sir?
Mr. Chair, as I said in my opening remarks, I appreciate your hearing my bill. I understand that yours is much more nuanced and has some reforms that I think are certainly valuable, and I'm interested in seeing some of those reforms go forward. This is a blunt, broad club to improve the renter's credit. Yours probably has a lot more merit, and I just look forward to having the opportunity to restore the value of the renter's credit to the renters in my district and across the state.
Thank you, Representative Morgan. Thank you to testifiers. With that, House File 173 will be held over for possible inclusion in the division report. Representative Dill, there you are. Representative Faust, would you like to move House File 554 to be before the committee?
I certainly would, Mr. Chairman.
For possible inclusion in the division report. And there are two amendments to House File 554. Let's get those amendments here. Representative Dill, are both of these your amendments?
Mr. Chairman, they are. The DE1 should be adopted first, the A2 second, and that'll have the bill in order that I would like to have it.
Excellent. Representative Faust moves the H554 DE1 amendment to be before the committee. This is author's amendment to get the bill in the form which the author prefers. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Then Representative Faust moves the H554A2 amendment. This, again, is an author's amendment to put the bill in the order the author prefers. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. No. Motion prevails. Representative Dill, to your bill as amended, sir.
Thank you, Chair Dabney. And Sustainable Forest Initiative Act. That's what we're talking about here. 2010, program was in, as I recall, 2001, the program was put in place. The purpose is to have private landowners from 80 acres all the way up into the biggest landowner in the state, which at the time was Boise Cascade Corporation with 305,000 acres of land in the state, to have stewardship plans and do for good forestry purposes, to keep our paper mills running, to keep the copy paper in this building, keep the toilet paper in this building, and do important work. At 1,920 acres and below, they did not have to have the land open to the public. So small landowners, if you want to call 1,920 acres as small, It could be an aggregate as it was enrolled in the program. So if you had 500 here and 200 here and so on and so forth, when you hit 1,920 acres, you had to have it open to the public, as well as a forest stewardship plan approved by the Department of Natural Resources. So the 1,920 acre threshold was so that public would have access, because most of this land is located up in the boreal forest up in the northern counties, of which you know I represent. But they include places down in Itasca and on down towards Brainerd and in those places, anywhere where there's a boreal type forest. And they also have them in other places where there's walnut forest, but those are on a much smaller scale, for example, and much smaller parcels, usually small private. Well, along came that program went like clockwork. The small landowners had good forest stewardship. They put up their wood eventually to get harvested, and the big landowners, of course, they managed their plans, their forest for commercial purposes and help us keep our industry running and keep the land from being fragmented. Now think about this. If you've got a big tract of land like 305,000 acres of land at Boise, and you start, the highest and best use might not be to raise trees. Maybe the highest and best use is to sell it off for cabins, 40 acres at a time, 80 acres at a time. So the purpose of the program was to de-incentivize that by giving them payments to encourage them to do the stewardship, keep it open to the public for the large landowners, and not fragment the land. So that we had what you see when you fly or drive up over my legislative district is this mass carpet of land that is forested. Well, in 2010, everyone in the state knows that we were suffering massive budget deficits. And in the special session of 2010, the governor insisted that they put a cap on the payments to landowners that had over 1,920 acres. So a company like, I'm going to continue to call them Boise Cascade, but they now have a new owner, and it's called Molpus Timber Company from Mississippi. And they suddenly went from a $2 million payment to a $100,000 payment overnight because of that cap. That raised a few eyebrows and a couple of lawsuits, and they lost. And so they came back and said, fine, we aren't going to have it open to the public anymore. That wreaked havoc in all of the northern parts of the state, because up there, the land ownership looks like a giant checkerboard, but instead of having just red and black, you've got red and yellow, black and white. All the land is precious in its sight. I mean, it's important, because in order to get county land, that was a little biblical shot. But anyway, I learned that in catechism. Anyway, the point of this is that if you've got a county land here, and state land here, and tribal land here, and federal land here, and you have, and then Molpus land, which is now the owner, you can't get to any of those unless you can go across the private, right? But if they close it because they're ticked off at us because they didn't get their payments like we promised them in a contract, they shut us off. So what happened was is the people started calling Senator Bach and I and others all across the north saying, what are you going to do about this? Well, what we're doing about it in this bill is to, number one, reestablish the payment by removing, at first off, at $7 for every acre, as it was, and taking the $100,000 cap so that they can reassume their payments that they receive and have to manage it as I described, make it open to the public, and let our industries continue to live into the future. Not only the timber industry and the paper mill industry, and the board industry, and the board, fiber board industry, but also recreational industries that depend upon this. Because imagine a state snowmobile trail that is a road like Highway 53 or like 61, and suddenly the person that we thought that we had an easement from to run a state highway over came to you and said, well, you really don't have it anymore. And that road is now two segments, one running to Eau Claire, and in the middle of it, it's divided at Duluth, and one going to the International Falls. I mean, it just wreaked complete havoc. So the bill reestablishes the $7 an acre payment to everyone. It removes the cap. And it also allows, the Second Amendment allows for re-enrolling in the program, because the Molpus Timber Company says, well, look, if you're not going to give us the payments, we're unenrolling and we're going to close it to the public. And they did. But we didn't. We told them that if you can make some progress on this down here, we're not going to will acquiesce and we'll have it open. So this year they left it open for public access, and next year they've told us they will close it. So problem is, it costs money. That's the reason that they reduced it to $100,000 cap. And there's five landowners that this affects in the whole state that's above the $100,000 cap. Five. And there are companies like Potlatch, Ryla Timber Company, Blandin, Mulpas, i.e. former Boise Cascade, and I think one land conservancy. I can't remember which one. Land Trust?
Nature Conservancy.
Nature Conservancy. Thank you, Representative Erickson. So that's the bill. It's going to cost, I think Ms. Schill said, on top of the payments that we're making now, if Mulpas re-enrolls, another $3.2 million. So the program would go back up to about the $7 million range, and right now it's about $3.8 million in payments. So we're talking about an additional $3.2 million, assuming that the Mulpas company re-enrolls. Now, I know that was a heck of a story, and but I mean, this is the problem. I want to add one more thing. I really was shocked about, I had two different reactions. One was as the local economy, who said, whoa, this action just ended recreation in northern Minnesota as we know it. But it didn't end recreation as we know it for local people. Because local people know how to get around the Mulpas land, because they know the territory, right? They can figure out, I want to hunt on that state 40 or 80 or quarter or a section. I can figure out a way to get around there. You know who called? You know the vast majority of the calls are Hennepin, Ramsey, and South. How are we going to get to our cabins? Where are we going to snowmobile? Where are we going to deer hunt? Where are we going to partridge hunt? How can we possibly do this if we don't have access?
You're just looking out for the folks in the metro, Representative Dill.
So, I mean, I'm just here helping everybody with this bill. So that's it.
All right. Ms. Schill, to the revenue note.
Mr. Chair and members, once again, your revenue note should be dated March 5th, 2013, for House File 554. This would begin with payments in calendar year 2014, so the fiscal impact would begin in 2015. Your revenue note addresses the DE1 amendment. It does not address the A2 amendment. So the impact of the DE1 amendment is approximately $2 million a year. And then if you look on the revenue estimate at the fourth bullet point, you'll see an additional 175,000 acres were removed from the SFIA. And if they are re-enrolled, that's the additional $1.2 million a year. So the bill as before us now would have an approximate $3.2 million impact for each year.
Right. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify regarding House File 554? Questions from members? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This isn't my area of expertise at all. I appreciate that you are, Representative Dill. But can you tell me what the interaction is with the legacy money that has also bought permanent easements and things like that in some of these lands? And I thought those required openness to the public. And so can you tell me kind of how these two things interact?
Okay. Representative Dill.
Excellent question. Good question. I like it, because I served on legacy, and as you know, this is a problem in this state. The lands that those companies, for example, Blandin, when they put a conservation easement on them with legacy dollars, those are then perpetually open. Mulpas Company had originally the Boise land of 305,000 acres, and they put a conservation easement on just about 50% of that. But on the rest of the land that was in this program prior to the cap, they don't have a conservation easement on that, so they can close it. It's private land, just like your yard or my farm or those kinds of things. Now, if at some point they agree and we agree to fund a conservation easement on it, it will be perpetually open then to the public. But there's 156,000, about half of the 305, that doesn't have, and that's where this quilt patchwork of land, the red and yellow, black and white checkerboard, comes into play, and it basically stops everything that goes on up there. If you have a, there's one road, it's called the Sheep Ranch Road. It has 27 cabins at the end of it, and for time immemorial, people have been going down this road that they thought belonged to somebody, but they didn't realize that it belonged now to somebody in Mississippi, and they put a gate across it. In fact, if you were watching Channel 5 News, they had about an 8-minute segment on it just a few nights ago about how it's going to have a massive impact if this doesn't get cured. Bill Lund was the narrator of that. So I hope that answered the question. Blandon has all of their land essentially in a conservation easement. It's open. Mopus has about half of their land in a conservation easement and half that is not. So the half that is not, they can close at their arbitrary decision.
Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dill, so if a forest owner did take the permanent conservation easement through legacy dollars, it's open. Do they also get to apply for these additional funds in this bill, or are they out of that?
They would be able to apply for the funds, the way I understand it. That's, I have to get back to you on the specifics of that and ask the department about that. Unless, because this is in revenue, and maybe Mr. Hintz knows the answer to this question specifically. As I'm understanding, they are still available to get this incentive.
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know the answer, but there is Mr. Hagan is here from the department. I wonder if he might have the answer.
And, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dill.
I do know that even though it's in a conservation easement, they still have to pay their taxes as if they owned it. I mean, the taxes don't get reduced just because it's in a conservation easement. The taxes stay the same.
Oh, sure. Because they've retained ownership.
Pardon me? I'm sorry?
That's because they've retained the ownership. They've just given an easement.
Welcome to the division, Mr. Hagan. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Hagan. I'm the director of the Property Tax Division. And, Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, in answer to your question, if they've sold their development rights through the legacy fund, as you're speaking about, they do still have the right to re-enroll in SFIA or continue in SFIA. So in effect, they've sold the right to develop, but on the other hand, we are, as a SFIA program, is making payments to them for participating in that program.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we have to kind of weigh whether, I mean, part of the legacy investment was to ensure access, and so I just still need to think through that access and how that all works with these payments.
Representative Dill.
Well, Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, we have the access. On the ones that have a conservation easement, we acquired the access rights we acquired access rights and we sold the development rights, but they still have the timber rights and they still pay taxes because they own the land. So there's no question that when they get a conservation easement, it is open to the public for hunting, skiing, trapping, snowmobiling, all of those uses. But they gave up the development rights and they have to maintain the land under a sustainable forest program that's administered through the department.
Thank you.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dill, is there a minimum length of time that you enroll in this program? I mean, is there some assurance or guarantee to have a minimum 5-year enrollment period or 10 years to kind of ensure the sustainability of this?
Mr. Hagan.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there is a, when you enroll in a program, you make an 8-year commitment to participate in the program, and you can withdraw after 8 years, but not before giving a 4-year notice. So the earliest you could get out would be if you participated for 4 years, gave written notice to withdraw, you could withdraw in 8 years. Otherwise, if you were in for 10 or 12 years and decided to get out, it would require an additional 4 years to get out.
Representative Hertaus.
Representative Dill, I will make a disclosure. I'm not a real estate attorney, but I've been around real estate quite a long time. Your 27 cabin scenario, in having used that for years, is called an easement by prescription. Mm-hmm. I think that one of the things that we haven't talked about in terms of the value of this is what it means to the tourism of the area, not only to the recipients of the revenue stream that comes there, but even to those who own nearby cabins or properties. so much of the value, and having been a cabin owner in northern Minnesota for more than 30 years, you know, it's really quite special when, even though you've had this private ownership has been open and free access to the public, and oftentimes there's little lakes and little places that, you know, aren't necessarily on the map, but really make northern Minnesota part of the jewel that it is in terms of being able to enjoy all of the recreational opportunities that are there. But I do know that, you know, even during a period of time when we seem to have quite a bit of lack of snow and the general degradation of snowmobiling and kind of a taking over of ATV, the towns up there certainly seem to suffer quite a bit in terms of you know, not having the folks from the metro area coming up there and generating revenues in the restaurants and just going out, sales tax, food and fuel, even lodging for those people who didn't have cabins. So I think there's an intangible benefit of maintaining this and keeping on the purpose of what it was, and that is to maintain the big open spaces and, you know, not use it for the highest and best use, which would probably be what I do, is develop.
Representative Dill.
Well, thank you for that. I told every single person that called me on the telephone that happened to live on that road or have a cabin on that road that I felt they had a prescriptive easement, and they all said, we don't want to spend the money on an attorney to go to court and have a judge decide that there's a prescriptive easement. I can get that too. And I appreciate the fact that you put a value on the fact that an economy is absolutely dependent upon this as well, as a rather than just the sustainable forest part of keeping paper mills and people employed, that there are ancillary industries that surround this. And I also want to put in one last thing about the snow you mentioned about. You know, we really don't have snow shortages up in my district. We have snow every single year. The biggest problem we have with snowmobiling up in my district is when it doesn't snow here, because they think about golf until it snows here, and they don't get the snowmobiles out of the garage until it snows here. And once it snows here, then they come up there and find, holy cow, they got snow up there. So that's the problem with snowmobiling.
Representative Hertz.
Just one last thing. There's very few traditions left in life, but one of them is for a lot of people who don that blaze orange in November. There isn't any uncertainty about anyone in a group that knows where they will be on the first Saturday in November. And some of those traditions take place on this type of land.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dill, are these large landowners Minnesota residents?
Representative Dill.
Not unilaterally, no. In fact, the Mr. Chairman, Representative Erickson, when Boise Cascade, of course, Boise Cascade was not a Minnesota-owned corporation. They're, you know, they're from Boise, Idaho.
Yes.
But they have a paper mill in International Falls that employs, you know, several thousand people. So very valuable to us. When they sold the land, the 305,000 acres of land, they sold it to the Meriwether Trust, which is out in Boston, and that was a forest management company. And then when they decided to sell the land, they sold it to the Mulpus Timber Management Company of Mississippi. So the answer to your question is in Ryla Timber Company, for example, who has a large tract of land with a conservation easement, they are a Minnesota company. So it's kind of a mishmash of ownership. And the one last thing I didn't say about this 305,000 acres split in half, like we explained to Representative Loeffler, is that that land affects literally millions of acres of access to other land, state, county, federal, tribal, all of those lands. I mean, it's just an incredible structure. It would be real simple if it were all one ownership, but it's not.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Dill, I know this was created while you and I served together, this program.
Right.
But did we create it so that these landowners would continue to plant trees so we would have, you know, the sustainable forest? Or did we design this for corporate welfare? I mean, why did we do this? I don't remember. And maybe you said it earlier and I didn't catch it.
Okay, well.
Representative Dill.
Really, actually, several purposes. First, in order of priority, in my estimation, and Representative Osmond was chairing the committee when we designed this, was that the highest priority was forest steward management, to keep our industries healthy and to keep our forest healthy for that matter. The second order of priority was to discourage fragmentation, so that when you, instead of having a 1,000-acre parcel, you end up with a 1,000-acre parcel less 10 40s that are sold off, and every time you have a 40 sold off, there's a gate and a cabin. Okay. The next item was to have access for recreational purposes, as I described, affecting the millions of acres of land by cutting off certain blocks that interrupt the whole essence of the landscape. Those were the three primary. I think the idea of some people have viewed this as corporate wealth, but frankly, now the price of the value of timber, because that's a free market, has gone from $100 a cord of wood,
yes,
down into the 20s. And so we just now became actually competitive with Mississippi wood and Arkansas wood and Alabama wood. Our industry in the housing, the 07 housing boom, sent our timber values up into the stratosphere, and that's the reason that, for example, Ainsworth of Canada, who has several mills in the United States, are now, are in Minnesota, are all closed because they couldn't compete. And so it's kind of a grand scheme, so to speak. I hope I answered your question.
You did, and that was very good. One last question.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Of this, the amendment on the re-enrollment, how many withdrew from the incentive program back in when we did this in the special session?
Representative Dill.
There may be
some. When you did it.
The only one that I am aware of that withdrew, and there, when the 2010 law passed, there was a provision that would allow withdrawal for those people that were affected by the $100,000 cap. And to my knowledge, Mulpus, then Meriwether Trust, because Mulpus just bought this last summer. The Meriwether Trust unenrolled about 156,000 acres thereabout, and they did that. No, I'm wrong on that. I may have to correct that. Meriwether, let me restate it. Meriwether withdrew it under the provision under the cap that allowed them to withdraw it, if that makes sense to you. And I think that's the only landowner that withdrew.
That's enough. Thank you. Very good, Representative Dill. That was very informative.
Further questions from members? Seeing none, House File 554, as amended, will be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report. Thank you, Representative Dill.
Thank you very much.
Welcome to the Property Tax and Local Government Division, Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chair, members.
And I will move your House File 749 for possible inclusion in the division report.
Very good. Thank you. Mr. Chair, members, House File 749 does four things, and then I'm going to briefly state them and turn them over to my testifiers. It extends St. Paul's half-cent sales tax to the year 2047. This tax is set to sunset in 2030. This extension is consistent with the City of Minneapolis did during the 2012 legislative session. This is used for economic development in the City of St. Paul. The second thing that this bill does is it continues the city's ability to use what we call the STAR Fund, which is $3.5 million, to pay principal on bonds for capital projects beyond December 31st, 2014. And we use this for capital projects throughout the City of St. Paul. The third thing it does is it provides flexibility to use 40% of the portion of the city's sales tax for economic development purposes if the amount necessary to meet our financial obligations to pay off the debt to the River Center complex in downtown St. Paul are satisfied. In 2015, the city will refinance the bonds on the River Center and use the $2.7 million they received in the Vikings bill last year to pay for the debt service moving forward. And the final thing, members, that this bill does is it requests that the new city, the new St. Paul Regional Ballpark, where the Saints will be playing, will be property tax exempt, which is why the bill is in this committee. This is consistent with the Viking Stadium, with the Twin Stadium, and there you have it. Those are the four things. So with that, I would turn it over for some brief comments to Todd Hurley or Sarah Erickson, whoever wants to speak. Todd is the CFO for the City of St. Paul, and Sarah is works for the city. Who wants to speak?
All right, well, welcome to the division, and please state your name for the record.
Good evening, Mr. Chair. Sarah Erickson, lobbyist for the City of St. Paul. I think Representative Paymar did a nice job outlining what the bill does, and I can go into more detail if anyone is interested, or we can just stand for questions.
Certainly. Questions from members? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Paymar, I just want to say what passed with Minneapolis last year actually took away what I had put in law, which was to parallel the St. Paul language to allow it to use the funds like your STAR fund. And instead, now it's fully dedicated to other purposes by state law. So just so you don't get us too confused, it's a little different. I'd love to have the St. Paul STAR program. I think you've done good things with it.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is to any one of the testifiers, but I noticed in the overview of the bill summary, grants a property tax exemption for a minor league ballpark built in St. Paul, similar to the exemption granted to the Viking Stadium and Twin Stadium. Of course, I've never voted for any of those bills, but why are we doing this property tax exemption? Isn't that going to raise taxes on others?
This is Todd Hurley.
Welcome to the division, Mr. Hurley.
Chair Dabney, Todd Hurley, Finance Director, City of St. Paul. Representative Erickson, the answer is you're correct. It basically goes to the affordability of us operating the ballpark. The City of St. Paul will actually own the facility, and therefore we're expecting to get to have a tax-exempt facility on the site with our relationship with our tenant. The Ramsey County Tax Advisor had advised us that we should get similar language as the Twins and the Vikings did, so there would be clear that we do have property tax exemption, and then we won't need to pay property taxes on a facility that we indeed own.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Erickson.
So who pays or who owns the present Saints Stadium?
Mr. Representative Erickson. The City of St. Paul owns the current. The Saints currently play at Municipal Stadium right. in St. Paul, and the city currently owns that facility too.
So
and that doesn't pay
and they
property
don't
tax.
Pay property
That's
tax.
Correct.
So
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Will there be a property tax increase possibly because of this other configuration here, losing the STAR program percentage, et cetera?
Mr. Hurley.
Representative Erickson, I don't anticipate a property tax increase due to the fact that this stadium will hopefully end up as a tax exempt facility.
We'll see. Thank you.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As money is diverted from the STAR program, what sorts of projects will go unfunded?
Mr. Hurley.
Representatives, when you say divert it from the STAR program, I'm not quite exactly sure what you're saying divert it from the STAR program. The intention of this language is really it's about an extension and it's about creating flexibility. The money would still go through the STAR process as currently planned. Are you
Representative Torkelson.
I apologize for my lack of understanding okay. of the details of the program, but I understand the stadium is a new participant in the STAR program. Is that well? Explain it to me. That is
Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chair, there's four parts to the bill. As I said, the three parts deal with the with the STAR program and the city half cent sales tax. The issue related to the Saints ballpark is totally separate. It has nothing to do with the half cent sales tax.
Representative Torkelson.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Schill.
Members and Representative Paymer, I want to call your attention. There were two revenue estimates done on this bill, and only one was in your packet, and I had the other one copied, and it's being distributed right now. The first talks about the impact of the local sales tax, 0.5%. And actually, if you go to the spreadsheet that I did, you'll see all of the impacts from both revenue estimates available. The second, though, is the property and local aids revenue note, and you've not seen it.
I haven't seen it.
Kyle, can you, or excuse me, would the page please make sure that the author gets a copy of the revenue note, please?
It basically shows a PTR impact in fiscal 2017. So what the property tax revenue estimate points out is some of the references to the state general levy and the other taxes that Representative Erickson was asking about.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If I can expound a little bit, Representative Erickson, this is the first time I've seen this, so I apologize. One of the good things about the City of St. Paul building this regional ballpark is that we're actually doing a land swap with the Port Authority. And so the Port Authority will be getting the Midway Municipal Stadium right now, which is actually located in an industrial area in St. Paul. So hopefully, we're hoping that the St. Paul Port Authority will redevelop that land and actually put business back on in an industrial area in St. Paul, so we can grow our tax base through that. I know that doesn't get to the exact question that you were talking about putting the ballpark downtown. Currently, the site that we'll be using is called the Diamond Products site in Lower Town in St. Paul. And
I live there.
Oh, so you're pretty familiar with the building, and it's a really old, not very attractive big cement building.
I mean, I live in the area.
I'm glad you don't live in it. So we'll be tearing that down and hopefully revitalizing Lower Town and anchoring it down there. The business community is really in support of it. I'm hoping to have a lot of people flood Lower Town for games and help our restaurants and bars and our music and our parks down there.
Representative Erickson.
Oh, thank you. Nice to have you back.
Good to be back.
Although Representative Lean does very well in your place, so I want to compliment him. He does. He's very good.
Thank you.
According to the, that Ms. Schill was referring to the revenue statement, the second bullet item does say the tax reduction for the stadium property would be shifted to the other properties subject to the state levy. So this would be the business property tax. Is that what you're referring to, Ms. Schill? If I may yield to her, Representative Dabney.
Certainly, Ms. Schill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, that's correct.
Thank you. Thank you.
Statewide property tax.
Got that. Now I think I'm understanding.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, the one thing I don't see in the bill or the summary, but I thought I heard in the presentation on the bill was about a dedicated use of the money that was given to St. Paul as part of the Vikings bill. And am I right that I don't see where that is dedicated within this legislation?
Yes,
Ms. Erickson.
Chair Dabney, it is in the bill, actually. And we don't speak specifically to the $2.7 million we got last year. On line 2.25, where it talks about the flexibility in the 40% of our sales tax. Right now, statutorily, 40% of the city's sales tax has to be used to pay debt service on the River Center. So what we're planning on doing is in 2015, we'll use the $2.7 million that the city received last year in the Vikings bill to pay that debt service on those bonds. And that frees up our local sales tax downtown to be used on economic development. We need statutory authority to use that, i.e. the flexibility. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to. So that's what we're asking for.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Then this makes sure that this is just the opposite of what happened to Minneapolis, because our debt service on the convention center was in law. Now you're switching it so that you don't have to use your half-cent sales tax for the convention center. Instead, you get to take the money that was granted and use that for other purposes. And so I'd say you have really maximized your flexibility compared to what our city has. I'm just saying, we're just now the opposite after if this were to go through.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to publicly thank my delegation.
Any other questions for the testifiers or the author? Representative Paymar?
No, Mr. Chair. I just think that this offers us a lot of additional flexibility for economic development in downtown, and we're very happy about the new St. Paul Regional Ballpark. I think it's going to be an extraordinary opportunity to refurbish in a part of downtown that has seen enormous growth, and we just appreciate your support.
Thank you very much.
The
members, the last bill for the day, House File 563, Representative Abler, there you are. Welcome to the committee. Representative Torkelson, would you like to move House File 563 to be before the committee?
I would
considered
have to do
for
that,
Mr. possible
Chair.
Inclusion? Thank you.
The things I don't.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Abler.
Nothing to do with baseball at all. I don't come to the tax committee very often. Last time I came up to David's committee, I brought a bill that I thought it was made some sense, and it cost about $750 million, and we said, maybe not today. So hopefully I'll do better on this one. This is a constituent brought to me a problem. You understand. Maybe you were there. You're like, ooh, this isn't what we had in mind. A constituent came to me with a concern. He tried to pay had a dispute with the city of Ramsey about something on his taxes, and which eventually got resolved in his favor. And so he went to pay his bill and said, I'm paying all but the part we're disputing. We're going to get it worked out. He probably put a note or something. I don't know how he exactly transacted it. He didn't come today, but it's a pretty small matter. But so because the county is not allowed to prorate it, they or to hold out one bit of the payment, they prorated everything. And so over the course of time, he got letters from every entity that has a line item on his tax bill saying he had paid their penalties, et cetera. And he thought he was just not going to pay the city part that they were working on. And so I'm not at all sure how this has been drafted in a way that is, I've gotten some feedback, but staff drafted it the best they could think of with just that idea. But it seems to me it's reasonable that a person, if they're having some dispute with a tax charging entity, and there's some hope it could be resolved, and a lot of people are kind of broke, that they could just withhold that, knowing that I don't take the penalties away or any consequence for not paying that bit, but at least they could segment out the city of Ramsey's payment and still pay the county and the railroad authority and the broadband fund or whatever else is on that. That's the whole idea. And if you like the idea, I wouldn't mind your help making it say just that, so it doesn't let people who are tax revolters and a whole new mechanism just to muck up the system. And maybe if there's some clause in it that says that they would attest that there's a dispute that's been duly, made known to the taxing authority, and it's in some kind of process, something like that. But that's the bill. That's the idea. And I'm open to help or questions, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Abler, you did answer one of the concerns of kind of what rises to there being a dispute. Is it me sitting in my chair being grumpy with one of the taxing jurisdictions, or do I have to take some sort of formal action to challenge the valuation of my property or whatever? So you've touched on that. What have you given thought to what is required to meet the definition of written notice? Is that a post-it note on the check? Is it something more formal and robust than something that the poor person processing might strip off and throw away in the process of trying to get their job done? Representative Abler.
Well, if I sense you kind of warming up to the idea, I think that a robust, something, a written notice and maybe even evidence of a copy of the letter they've sent or some notification that there's a bona fide thing going on. I don't see this is going to be used by a lot of people, but it just kind of struck me that the county was not allowed to segment out the thing. That's what drove me to come here. And if you know, coming before a tax committee is a desperate act for me, so I hope you understand the depth of my concern. So,
all right, that it's deep. Mr. Hines, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I was just going to clarify that the bill as drafted does not allow the person to withhold part of their city property tax. It refers to other kinds of charges and fees that can be billed on the property tax statement, service fees, special assessments. There are a number of kinds of authorities, jurisdictions, mostly cities, have to put sort of bills on the property tax statement, and this addresses those kinds of bills or charges. So it doesn't allow the taxpayer to, as drafted, to sort of withhold part of the city of Ramsey's property tax levy, but just as these other fees or charges.
So, Mr. Hines, if I'm disputing the valuation of my property or some other dimension of the property tax, current law would still apply. It's through a partial payment.
Mr. Chair, there would be nothing in this bill that would allow you to withhold part of the property tax statement. Whatever your dispute was regarding the property tax per se, mm-hmm. would not be affected as the bill is drafted right now.
All right. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
And, you know, we don't have to pay tuition to come to Legislature College. But some of these bills I put in, particularly tax bills, I always have a learning opportunity that comes to me. And when I was having it drafted, I didn't pay attention to even the terminology of the nuances. I just pay my tax bill. For how much as I vote on tax bills, when my bills come, I just like, holy cow, that's a lot of money, and I try to find the money and I pay. And I don't, frankly, I should pay more attention, but I don't notice assessments or just write the bottom number and pay this much. And sometimes it's an odd number from last time because the pennies are rounded off. But I'm open to advice on that part later. And I think you're holding these things over for certainly likely conclusion or inclusion in the bill, so that would be. So I'll work on that part.
All right. I've had similar experience in front of the Health and Human Services Committee. We can review my experience with MCHA some other time. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hines, do you mean that a sewer district assessment or fee could be withheld per this language?
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, yes, correct. That would be exactly the kind of charge that could be under this, that this bill addresses.
Representative Erickson.
Mr. Chair, I might have several who would like this. Just, you know, forestall mm-hmm. paying that little piece for a while. But I think it's going to be hard to enforce, Representative Abler. With little post-it notes on checks and...
Nasty things written in the memo line?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Are there any other questions from members to or statements to educate Representative Abler?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler, your final, your closing comments, sir.
Well, I know you want to go home. As a group, I'm not crazy. I mean, there's somewhere to go with this. If I can figure out some kind of a proper notice so you don't get spurious people who just don't feel like paying something. I don't want to give those folks relief. You got to pay your taxes. It's a law, and the jurisdictions count on that. I didn't want, there was a bill before that they were waiving half the fee. I'm not trying to solve any of that. If you don't pay and you should have paid, then you got to pay what that plus the interest, and it's a pretty big number, so there's quite an incentive to do it on time. But these are people who are quite certain that they're going to get it worked out, or they're fighting it because they feel like they've been aggrieved. And they would be, part of the leverage they have is that they, you know, that they are still have the money, you know, and that, or they don't have the money to give, and they expect to win, and so why would they have to give the city or whoever the money? So that's the issue. But if we can figure out something with the right notice and decide what we're going to, if it's a tax or assessment, whichever ones are even appropriate, I might ask one of my colleagues that knows something about this on the floor, certain other former property tax chairs, just to guide me on this. But there's somewhere to go, perhaps, if I can get this figured out. Is that your sense, Mr. Chair?
You are certainly free to work on this bill further.
Mr. Chair, that doesn't seem all that encouraging, but I appreciate it.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Abler. With that, Representative Torkelson renews his motion that House File 563 be held over for possible inclusion in the division report. I'm sorry. Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify regarding House File 563? Oh, we have a winner. My apologies, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Bo Bernson with the Association of Minnesota Counties. I'll be extremely brief. I think the committee and the author correctly identified that there's a disconnect between what is in this bill, what he's hoping to accomplish, and I'm happy to work with him, and we can talk through some of those issues he's raised.
Thank you, sir. Any questions for the testifier? With that, thank you very much, Representative Abler.
Chair, and for all the help.
Certainly. We're done, right? All right. Oh, thank you very much. What date? I don't have them. Oh, thank you very much. Representative Hertas, when's the last time you moved the minutes?
I have not had a moving experience in quite a while. So
well, then by all means, Representative Hertas moves the minutes of the February 27th, 2013 committee hearing. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion prevails. Thank you. With that, we are adjourned.